I will tell you a story that was told to me. No names, please. A cutter at Huntsman, I knew quite well. He said, you know, Mr. Bora, I have a customer. He's a French aristocrat. I think he's a count. He said, every 6 months or so, he comes in here with a different young lady. He buys a pair of custom-made jodhpurs for her. And then he paused and said, and I know that they're not interested in horses.
This story that Bruce heard is surprising to me for one big reason. And it's not that French aristocrats have kinky sex. I mean, that's kind of their thing, right? No, what surprises me is that he heard this story from a Savile Row tailor. And in the popular imagination, just think of the recent movie Kingsman, they're supposed to be aloof, distant, almost puritanical. But Bruce has seen another Savile Row, the real Savile Row, because he's been visiting for almost 60 years. This is Unbuttoned, G. Bruce Boyer's Life in Clothes, Chapter 2. Unbuttoned is brought to you by Shibumi Firenze. Among all their accessories, owner Benedict Fry stocks some of the nicest grenadine and madder silk ties I've seen anywhere. And don't just take my word for it.
The last time I was with him, I was saying that I appreciated that he was keeping the standard of his quality up. And he said, well, you know, when I get into the business, I took a course on how to make neckwear. So I know when I look at a necktie whether it's well made or not.
Discover grenadine, madder silk, knit ties, and more at shibumi-firenze.com. Use the offer code UNBUTTONED for 10% off. I'm Pedro Mendez, and I've long dreamed of visiting the birthplace of tailoring, the home of storied houses like Gives and Hawkes, Huntsman, Henry Poole, Anderson and Shepard. For me, those names evoke not only history, but a commitment to dressing with decorum, propriety, elegance. But, of course, I've never been there. And even when I do eventually make it to Savile Row, I'll never know what it used to be like, before big brands moved in, before the casual revolution threatened the existence of the place. Bruce, however, well, he started going about a decade before I was even born.
To me, 1963, it was a very important date because I had just graduated from college and I got accepted into grad school. So I was, you know, enormously proud and happy and relieved. And I had a little money that I had saved up doing odd jobs and so forth. And I decided that what I would do was see if I could grab a cheap flight to Europe. I had gone to a Savile Row, and I kind of peered in at the glass windows where I could, but it was really very intimidating still at that point. You know, there were all sorts of stories about how you needed recommendations to give them your money, right? None of which, by the way, was true. But I mean, at that time, I mean, we're talking about more than a half a century ago, a lot of the better shops in London still had a kind of, Dickensian quality to them, you know? And I mean, you almost expected somebody like Mr. Micawber or Scrooge or somebody to come out of the back room wearing a frock coat and a celluloid collar or something. Is that kind of thing?
There's a very good reason Bruce had that reaction. Savile Row has been around for a long, long time. And when he first visited, it was holding on strong to that history. The first tailors to set up on what was originally called Savile Street opened their shops over 200 years ago, around the year 1800. That's when a number of houses opened in the area that are still around today, including Mayer and Mortimer, Norton and Sons, and most prominently, Henry Poole and Company. For the next 100 years, until World War I, bespoke tailoring was one of England's most important industries. But the massive social shifts after the Great War, pretty much putting an end to the aristocracy's dominance of society and the economy, meant a lot less work for tailors. Yet it was the aftermath of World War II, with the mass introduction of ready-to-wear clothing and more casual wardrobes, that was the Row's greatest challenge. In the face of all this change, many of the older tailors who had been around through both wars held on to Victorian values as if they would somehow save them.
I wandered back onto to Regent Street, and about halfway up Regent Street between Piccadilly Circus and Oxford Street, there was a little tailor shop which looked just wonderful. I mean, it looked like a tailor shop ought to look. The shop was called Bailey and Wetherill, and that's because the one cutter's name was Bailey and the other was Wetherill. I went very timidly into the shop because, I mean, I had never had that kind of experience before. It was a long, narrow shop with an old kind of Victorian desk in the front and painted a kind of old creamy color with the old Persian rugs on the floor. And in the back, there were a couple of fitting cubicles, you know, cut off from the rest of the room with gray flannel curtains, you know, that kind of thing, and an old chandelier or two. I mean, it was just a little bit dusty. A gentleman came up to me who I later found out was Mr. Wetherill himself. I would have said at that time he was maybe about 60 years old and just a little portly, but incredibly well-dressed and groomed. I mean, my God, he was wearing a beautiful worsted pinstripe suit and a immaculate white shirt and a blue and white polka dot tie, and I mean, he just looked like the epitome of what an Englishman would look like, you know. So he came up, you know, and said, "May I help you, sir? And you can trust me to always find the right words." I blurted out, "Well, I wanted a suit." And he said, "Well, sir, I think you may have come to the right place." You know, so. And then he said, "You'll pardon me, sir, but I couldn't help but notice that you're an American." And he said, I wanted to caution you. He said that we really don't cut an American style suit. And what he meant was that they didn't do a kind of Ivy League garment, you know, a sack suit. They didn't do that. They did a shaped suit.
If you haven't listened to it, chapter one of this podcast series is all about Ivy League. Go back and listen. We'll wait. Okay, so did Bruce travel all the way to Savile Row for a sack suit?
No. I wanted an English suit. You know, I wanted a suit with some shape and so forth. And he said, "Oh, what wonderful, sir." You know, and so he took me to a table and sat me down, and I started to look through the swatch books. I came across a particular swatch. I forgot. I think it was a green with a kind of yellow and orange, you know, kind of window pane effect and so forth. And I could sense him behind me, kind of just looking over my shoulder, you know. He saw me really looking at this one. I wanted to ask him about it. And so I said, "Do you think that this would be too loud?" And he said, "Well, sir," he said, I wouldn't exactly say it was loud, but I do think it mutters a bit, don't you?" I think what I ended up with was a very traditional three-piece, single-breasted, lovely West of England a flannel, probably from Fox Brothers.
If you're new to the world of bespoke tailoring, Bruce wasn't buying a suit so much as he was beginning a process. Since everything is custom-made, often with a fair amount of handwork, it takes a long time with many steps. And so, lots of visits to the tailor.
So that Wednesday or Thursday afternoon, I came back and he gave me a fitting. I was looking at what the suit looked like on me, and it had a very definite shoulder and a kind of hourglass shape and lovely narrow trousers. And for some reason, it just reminded me of something. At first, I couldn't put my finger on it. You know, the silhouette. The silhouette had a kind of strangely familiarity to me. Finally, it dawned on me. At the time, there was a British show that had come here called The Avengers.
Yeah, yeah. This isn't The Avengers you're thinking of. No capes, no CGI, no Robert Downey Jr. This Avengers was a spy show from the swinging 60s, and it was over-the-top camp, more Austin Powers than James Bond. And it starred Patrick McNee.
The suit that was being made for me by Mr. Wetherill looked very much like the kind of stuff that Patrick McNee was wearing in that TV series. He said, "Thank you very much, sir. Mr. McNee is one of our best customers." So that was my introduction to the world of Savile Row. And I'll tell you, it was, how can I put this? It was just horrible, because once you've done that, you can't go back. I mean, I was just hooked and not really satisfied with clothing just from a department store off the rack anymore. It becomes your hobby, you know. I would like to think it's not an obsession, but maybe the line between hobby and obsession is a rather fine one. And about 4 or 5 months after that, after I was back home, I had gotten a letter that Mr. Bailey had sent out to Mr. Wetherill's customers saying that he had passed away. And then a couple months after that, I got another letter saying that even Mr. Bailey was retiring because he, you know, either couldn't or didn't want to carry on without his partner. And so Bailey and Wetherill was no more. The next time I went back, of course, Bailey and Wetherill weren't there. And I decided that I would go to the row itself and look at the really, you know, legendary tailors, the Henry Pools, the Huntsmans, the Dijon Son, Anderson and Shepherd. And in fact, there were at that time even some of these newer guys, Edward Sexton and Tommy Nutter.
This was actually a pivotal time in Savile Row's history. In the face of a dwindling clientele, while the more traditional tailors held on to their old ways, I'm talking no advertising, not even window displays, a new generation brought 60s counterculture to the row. First, Douglas Hayward started attracting Hollywood-style icons like Steve McQueen and Michael Caine to bespoke tailoring. Even a young Ralph Lauren. Hayward's shop became a hub for the young and famous. Then the real shock, in 1969, when Tommy Nutter and his partner Edward Sexton arrived on the scene. They used traditional tailoring techniques, but they created suits that were wild, both in pattern, more like a few clashing patterns, and design, famously tight with wide lapels and massively roped shoulders. Before long, their customers included the likes of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. In fact, except for George, it's their suits on the cover of Abbey Road. And their shop became the antithesis to prudish England. Nutter's of Savile Row was brash, flamboyant, and sexy. Not really Bruce's thing. As you know from chapter one of this series, he isn't a huge fan of 60s counterculture.
It was, to my mind, absolutely the worst period for clothing and music that has ever existed in the history of mankind.
But at the same time, he wasn't interested in some of the older, more traditional Savile Row houses.
I've always favored softer garments, clothes that had a little less structure to them. You know, I mean, some of the English tailors, again, with no names, please, but you got the impression that some English tailors not only made clothes, but they made battleships. Because, you know, they did a very hard suit. I mean, it had incredible shape, but it had a very architectural look, you know, as though you could stand it up in a corner, you know, without a person in it, and it would still be there, you know. Anderson and Shepard was really very different. I mean, they did a very soft suit. Even if you used a very heavy fabric, the suit seemed soft and lightweight because they didn't use a lot of, let's say, infrastructure. You know, they didn't use a lot of heavy padding. They didn't use a lot of heavy interlinings. It had an easy kind of familiarity to it. You know, it looked in a way as though it were almost broken in already when you first got it. And I love that idea because my idea was always that clothing should be comfortable. It should reflect you.
Before Bruce tells us his story of the very first time he visited Anderson and Shepard, a word from this week's sponsor. This episode of Unbuttoned is brought to you by Maison Le Parem. Based in Montreal, Canada, Maison Le Parem offers made-to-measure clothing tailored in Europe, as well as a variety of fine accessories through their online shop. They have ties from Spaca Neapolis and pocket squares from Olaf 1982. I happen to have one of each in my wardrobe, and I can attest to their quality and taste. Good stuff, made well, that looks great. In fact, the guys behind Maison Le Parem, Collins and Claudio, I've met them a number of times, and what impresses me most is their European approach to dress, which is refreshing in Canada. They make business wear stylish and casual wear sharp. Find out more at maisonleparem.com. That's L-E-P-O-R-E-M. Apologies for my terrible pronunciation. Now, back to Bruce as he walks into Anderson and Shepard for the first time.
I went in there and the gentleman who walked up to me was absolutely the most elegant man I'd ever seen in my life. His name was Colin Harvey, and at that time, he was probably in his early 40s or so. He was tall and slim, and he had such an erect but easy posture, and he was just dressed beautifully. I remember exactly what he was wearing. He was wearing a dark gray flannel, double-breasted chalk stripe suit, and he was wearing a shirt with a white collar, but the body of the shirt was a pale salmon color, and his necktie was a satin of a slightly darker salmon color. And I thought, wow, I mean, I've never seen anything like this in my life. He was a very conservative English dandy. And he was something of a legend. It was said that he could cut a suit without measuring it, that he could do it freehand. He could draw a suit on the fabric freehand. The first thing I got from him was a tweed jacket, a lovely, it was a dark green herringbone with a very faint burnt orange window pane over it. I mean, it was just gorgeous. And I remember at the second fitting, when it was almost finished, because he worked very quickly too and did just a beautiful job. I put the coat on and we were looking at it, and I always thought that these final fittings were more for him than they were for me, because I was happy with it. But I thought he just wanted to admire his work. You know, I mean, he was so well done. But anyway, you know, he looked at it and he said, what do you think, Mr. Boyer? And I said, I think it's perfect. And he said, I think we might be able to give you a bit more waist. So he took it in about a quarter of an inch in the waist.
As much as some of the young and flamboyant tailors attracted young and flamboyant stars, Anderson and Shepard's clientele included its fair share of Hollywood's elite, going back all the way to the 1930s and 40s.
Colin Harvey, he had been at Anderson Shepard for a long time, and he was around when Fred Astaire used to come in. I mean, Astaire was, you know, an Anderson Shepard guy. And he told me this wonderful story that when Astaire came in for a try-on, that he would put the garment on, the suit, and he would dance up and down the hall to make sure that it fit the way he wanted it to when he danced. You know, that it wasn't pulling him in the crotch, or that the neck stayed where it was supposed to be, and that kind of thing. I said, that's wonderful. I mean, you got a free performance. He said, oh, it was wonderful. He said he would pirouette up and down and leap back and forth. And he said he was very particular about things. If he felt that the coat wasn't sitting firmly on the neck, he would say, no, he said, this one's no good. He said, you have to make it fit on the neck. This turns out, by the way, to be another sad story, I'm sorry to say, because Colin died quite young, too. I think about 5 years or so after I had met him and gotten several garments from him, he died too unexpectedly. So, but I got another cutter at Anderson and Shepard. So I think I've been going to them off and on for, well, ever since about 1965, 67, something like that.
An awful lot has changed on the row since Bruce started going. Way too much to include in this podcast. But there are three big shifts that Bruce has witnessed.
Today, there's a lot more designers. Savile Row tailors used to consider themselves tailors. Now, more and more of them think of themselves as designers. You know, they make a certain look, and they're not particularly interested in your input. I think that's one thing. I think, of course, there's more ready wear around now. I'm trying to think. I can't think that there were any ready wear sold in Savile Row when I first started to go there, but now there are all sorts of ready wear shops. Some of them selling clothing that really is a pretty low quality, I think. And then the third thing that's pretty obvious is that they all do a bit more advertising. You know, they have to. It used to be that the fathers would bring the sons in and introduce them to their cutter, and then the son would have clothes made, and of course he would bring his son in, and that kind of thing, you know. And so they knew their customers, they knew who they could count on, and it was pretty steady. But that's not true anymore, of course.
I haven't known Bruce that long, but I know him well enough that when he told me stories about growing up with the Ivy League look, it made perfect sense to me. He certainly has a bit of the professorial in his wardrobe. But there's much more to his style than I could really put my finger on, because while it certainly has the rumpled elegance of American style, there's also a sharpness around the edges, a strong touch of refinement. And now I know where that came from. His time spent in England, hanging out with Savile Row tailors and stocking up on Savile Row suits. In fact, Bruce says, his visits had a profound influence on him.
It completely changed my, you know, direction and my thought and my perspective on things. It really was an incredible learning experience for me.
To do some more learning yourself, Bruce has an in-depth history of Savile Row in his book, Elegance, which is kind of a required reading for this podcast. On the next chapter of Unbuttoned, Bruce's first visits to that other center of men's style, Italy. This podcast is a production of the Hogtown Rake. Thank you for listening.